This is Juliana Garcia, and you are tuned in for another episode of Fresh from the Hill. Today, I am interviewing Ben Ortiz, who is the curator of the hip-hop collection at Cornell University. How are you?
I'm good. Juliana.
Hey.
Juliana.
We meet again. Eres.
Anybody know that song by DLG?
Yes.
Email me, you get 2 points if you know that song.
So, tell me more about the hip-hop collection, because we've chatted in the past, and I feel like it was a number of years ago when you were, like, in the thick of it, and we had a different podcast episode. Mm-hmm. So where is it at now?
The Cornell Hip-Hop Collection is a collection of archives, right? And it's located in Kroc Library in the Rare and Manuscript Collections division of the Cornell Library. We estimate that we're presently... as this is being recorded in the fall of 2019, we're something around 750,000 artifacts. So getting close
Wait, for just the hip hop collection?
Correct.
Oh my gosh.
Correct. And I'm talking about 750,000 items, meaning every last photograph, every last piece of paper, every last sound recording. Meaning we are the world's most voluminous collection of material on the subject of hip-hop history and culture. Oftentimes, people think that it's just a record collection or something. And I think the word collection to people generally triggers that thought, right? Record collection, hip-hop collection. We're talking about a collection of distinct archives. A famous example is the Crazy Legs Archive. Crazy Legs is one of the most influential hip-hop dancers, specifically a b-boy, a break boy, a break dancer, in history globally. We have his archive, and we have hundreds and hundreds of papers and flyers, some video, some audio and video material. But, you know, that's kind of what we mean when we're talking about an archive, right? You have the opportunity to look deeply into this person's life and career and get a lot more context about what was happening at a particular moment in time. And we see researchers on a
that's what I was going to ask you.
Almost daily basis.
It?
Oh, yeah, almost daily. I just had a lengthy conversation with a PhD student from UC Riverside in L.A., yesterday, who's visiting this week. She's doing some research in the Crazy Legs Archive, as well as the Pop Master Fable Archive and others, because she's working on the use of digital technology and dance, whatever that means for her particular dissertation. So there's a lot of scholarship being done about digital technology and dance across the globe, but not necessarily about A, hip-hop, B, things that deal with non-academic sort of high-level, quote-unquote, high-level art, performative dance, right? So I'm talking about popular dance, folk dance, dance that comes not from an academic space or a theater space or an aristocratic space, but dance that comes from the people, right? If that makes sense. We could dive deeply into it, but I don't know how long this episode is supposed to be, Juliana. You tell me.
We're just rolling with this.
So we see researchers on a weekly basis, daily basis. They could be not only Cornell undergraduate students, Cornell graduate students, but people doing research from other universities, other institutions, other media outlets, people from and in the past, we've had NPR, HBO, Netflix, people making independent documentaries, you know, lots of magazines, New York Times, Washington Post, and the list goes on. European magazines, Asian magazines, Australian magazines.
Do you have to find these items to put in the collection, or do people like contact you and say, hey, like, I want to donate all of this? Like, how does that work? Do you have a budget?
Mm-hmm. Good question. There's a slew of different ways that we acquire the material, starting with, as you just alluded to, individual items. So there is a field, a trade called antiquarian book dealership, right? And that particular trade has evolved in recent decades to include pop cultural materials, materials from the last century, as opposed to things that are hundreds and hundreds of years old, as was most popular in their trade previously. So we could look at a professional antiquarian book dealer catalog, find an item, and purchase it. But that is not the majority of what we do, because we wouldn't be talking about approaching a million items with that particular model, right?
Because it's expensive, or?
Well, because it's time-consuming, it's laborious. Yes, it's expensive, but just adding things one at a time just simply takes longer, right? Instead, as I was pointing out with Crazy Legs as an example, when we build a relationship with a person who I tend to call them cultural VIPs. Mm-hmm. So that's a way of including not only artists and performers, but also people who might be journalists, photographers, business managers, club managers, record label owners or A&Rs or PR people, things like that. So cultural VIPs, right? Working with them to develop a relationship and have their lives, their careers, archives come to us as a bulk group of material, we instantly have thousands of things arriving in several boxes. And in the case of some archives, you know, hundreds of boxes. So that's why, since we were founded in 2007, we've gone from an initial group of materials, about 6,000 things. We've gone up to 750,000 things in 12 years. So
do you work by yourself, or do you have a team that you work with?
I work with one other person closely. That's my supervisor. Okay. Her name is Catherine Reagan, and she is the curator of rare books and manuscripts for our department. So essentially the head curator of our department. And there are lots of other subject curators who report to her, myself included. So she's the person that I work most closely with. There tends not to be other staff in my department who do any curatorial work on behalf of the hip hop collection. However, there are people who do cataloging, processing. Okay. We have a conservation department that, in the case that we bring in something that is really fragile or damaged, they can repair it and create special containers to house the materials. And they do some really brilliant work there. We have a digitization department that when we bring in specific audiovisual material that needs to be digitized, that's what they're working on. So there's a team of processing after the fact, but building the relationships and bringing the material into the fold in the first place is myself and my supervisor.
So you probably come in contact with some like pretty heavy hitters for hip hop then, if you're the one who's having to like go out there and like develop these relationships and stuff. And like, it sounds like you're perfect for this job. So did they just like create it and we're like, Ben, that's the person who we're calling? Like, how did this come about?
You know, I it wasn't created for me, you know, but I will say that never before, and as, you know, as we were talking a little bit before we clicked record, I've worked at Cornell for 17 years, and I've had some really amazing roles, amazing jobs, amazing positions, doing some amazing things and with amazing people in the past. And yet, never before have I felt like, okay, this is the reason I'm on Earth right now, right? This really does feel like the perfect match for all of my various reference points and skill sets and interests.
So did you just like stumble upon it on Workday and you were like, what?
No, just in Workday. For those who don't know, Workday is our HR software, job listings and so forth. No. So the Hip Hop Collection was founded in 2007 with an initial group of materials that arrived, 6,000 things, and the intent was to continue adding archives to that to make a collection of archives, hence the title Hip Hop Collection, right? When that material first arrived, you know, much to my supervisor's credit, she said, you know, this is important cultural material. Researchers will want to see this material. They want to use this material. So it's important stuff, but really that's kind of the thing she knew about hip hop, that it is important, not necessarily the details and the culture and the history. and so forth, right? And the aesthetics. Yeah. So the need arose for her to assemble an advisory board of people, myself included, a few professors and staff, local folks to help sort of guide where this thing will eventually go. How should it look online? Yeah. What should the exhibitions look like? How should this material be treated in classrooms, et cetera, right? So I was fortunate enough to be asked to join that inaugural advisory board back in 2007. And then fast forward 4 years to 2011 when the position was created that I hold now. And, you know, unbeknownst to me, I had been on a 4-year job interview.
Yeah.
As a result of being in this advisory board.
Position.
And this was while, by the way, I was the K-12 outreach coordinator at the Cornell Public Service Center. This is a very, very different role. Nevertheless, I still do some of that work in working with local school children, except it's about exposing them to not only hip hop's history and culture, but libraries. It's an opportunity for young people to come to campus and explore what is campus, because a lot of research is done about, you know, when you grow up just sort of expecting that you will go to college, then it's more of a foregone conclusion that you will go to college. And, you know, there are a lot of young people we're working with in this instance that aren't necessarily being sort of pumped and primed to think about college. So it's, I see this as a really great byproduct of having a hip hop collection, you know. Anyhow, that's really the short version of why I'm in this role.
Yeah.
You know, not to pat myself on the back too much, but being a lifelong hip hop nerd is not something I ever thought would result in a career.
Well-paid job, yeah.
You know, well, yeah, it wouldn't. I didn't think it would be my career, but you know, mix that with the student services background and the outreach background, and you know, knowing this community and this campus as well as being able to network with others, you know, I'm convinced that I have my dream job. I would be a very happy individual to have this position really for the rest of my career. I still feel like I'm at the tip of the iceberg.
So what are some ideas, you know, that you have for going forward? I'm sure you're filled with them.
Yeah. Well, I think that there are lots of opportunities for hip hop studies conferences to take place here at Cornell. Rapidly increasing amount of scholarship being done about hip hop music and culture. There's an increase in classes being taught every semester.
You're teaching one, right?
I teach a class in the spring. Yep. I teach a one-credit class in the library, but through the Performing and Media Arts Departments, which is the credit-issuing institution within, you know, because the library does not issue credits. But my class is called Digging Through Hip-Hop, Artifacts and the Art of Facts. Which, if you could insert
an amazing name.
Insert a little rim shot there. But that's my class in the spring. But on a weekly basis, almost, I'm pretty much speaking with other professors' classes. So they build a visit to the archives into their syllabus and then bring their students down to get a lecture from me. Sometimes there's two, sometimes there's three. And sometimes I work with certain classes more or less all semester long. That's more rare. But I've got two classes this semester that I'll be doing two sessions with, one of whom will be visiting on Monday, this coming Monday. They want to get an understanding of hip hop's history, understanding of the hip hop archives. And then the second visit that they'll be doing to my classroom is specifically to get a DJing demonstration.
I like it.
Because this class... taught by a brand new professor here in Africana and Feminist Gender Sexuality Studies, Tao Lee Goff. She's having her students produce a mix, a DJ mix, as their final project. And we're hoping that we can find a public place to have the students essentially debut these mixes as their final presentation, perhaps downtown. I need to talk to some venues downtown and see who would be game for that. But they're also, you know, it also happens to be the case that I'm a DJ, which dovetails very nicely with this job. This job is what made me really want to get serious about DJing. I had always just messed around, somebody's house party here and there, a couple of random gigs here and there. But it made me get more serious when I'm hanging out with people like DJ Rich Medina and Breakbeat Lou and, you know, having lunch with Flash and meeting with Bambaataa and people like that. So those are the legendary types of shoulders I get to, you know, rub up against, rub elbows with, I think. And, you know, it's been a privilege and an honor. And I do feel like I'm really at the tip of the iceberg. There's so much more to be done. You know, I have colleagues who have been the curators in their particular subject. So, for example, I have a colleague who has been the curator of Icelandic studies for decades, and that is firmly his career. He's doing what he does. There's always something going on with that. The Icelandic government made him essentially a knight of the Icelandic government, which is, you know, you think of when the British crown like makes whatever Elton John a knight or something. They did this with my colleague, and the president of Iceland came to the library.
That's amazing.
This was in the news. Go back and search our Cornell website, and he's, you know, with the sword on the shoulder.
That's great.
Yeah, it's dope. And I've got another colleague, the curator of the Human Sexuality Collection. She's been the curator of that collection since its inception 25 years ago. It's very, again, firmly her career. And there's always work being done around this particular topic. So the work never ends. And that's an exciting thing. It's not just about making sure, as some people think, oh, it's just a matter of collecting every single album ever recorded in hip hop. That is not what this is about. Mm-hmm. That is not what this is about at all. It's about making sure that a particular community with a particular history, you know, set of cultural values, aesthetics, and philosophies is well represented from, you know, its inception right up to its present day. You know, in this archival record.
Yep.
And the archival record in this particular case includes lots of other communities that have had the privilege of being archived since archives as an academic pursuit started, right? But we're talking about, fundamentally, we're talking about society's have-nots, right? Folks who are not in the aristocracy, folks who are not privileged enough to be super well represented in the archives of a place like Cornell University. So leading that particular charge is something I'm very passionate about and something that is, you know, I've been very happy that the whole university, frankly, has been very energized and hyped about this type of work. I've met with several Cornell presidents over, you know, since Skorton was here.
Yep.
Shout out to David Skorton. That's my
Skorty
man.
Skorty Spice.
Hey,
I miss
man.
You.
Yeah, we miss him. He and I used to exchange mix CDs back in the day. Believe
oh
that?
Oh, my God. I'm so jealous.
Yeah, you know, several Cornell presidents have shown up and taken a look. And, you know, it's from the top to the bottom, full support.
I also, like, don't want you to undersell the fact that you're doing so amazing at the job. And that's probably why Cornell is recognizing it so much, right? Like, I'm not sure if someone else was in the position who didn't have, like, this passion and enthusiasm and love for hip-hop, it would be going in the direction that it's going in right now, right?
I mean, that's a fine hypothesis. I mean, you make it. I don't want to say that. I don't want to say that.
You're like, but since you brought that up.
But you know. Well, actually, I mean, I think that it is important that anyone in a role like mine, whose job is essentially being the steward of priceless, rare, important cultural artifacts. It's very important that that person is, you know, what we say, you know, in hip hop, ride or die for that particular subject.
Yeah.
Really important that that person is not just kind of in a job.
Yep.
Right? It needs to be kind of like the identity that makes them tick. And I think that that is the case for me. Just the idea that I'm the steward of this trove of priceless cultural artifacts that the world will be learning from for hundreds of years into the future. That makes me tick, right? And how often are people saying that about their job? So I, you know,
like never.
I feel super privileged to have this role. And, you know, I do hope that whoever's listening right about now and is interested in learning more, please put my contact info in the show notes and by all means, reach out. My cell phone number is actually on my business card and my email, so it's public. Just text me. That's dope. Email me. It's all good. Facebook me, whatever. Instagram me. I'm that guy. I respond to folks. So, yeah.
I desperately hope everything from your life is going in this archive. All your paintings. Oh, you know what?
That's funny you say that, because someone has told me that. Like, look.
Yes, I'm serious.
Because we look at, you know, we find archives of our predecessors, our curatorial predecessors, yes, who worked at Cornell, you know, many, many decades ago, and their archives are indeed. And so, yeah, the idea that somebody one day is going to study me trips me out. It makes me a little uncomfortable. But it is what it is, you know? My name, yeah, is, my fingerprints is on it. So
I would also like to say that Ben is an amazing artist. Like, very, very, very good. And so he has these huge, huge paintings, right, that... Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah.
And also, our producer is sitting right here, so I'm talking to her as well.
Hey,
can you please put
what's
pictures?
Up, Amanda?
Yeah, what's up,
She's
Amanda?
She's not talking.
Can you please put pictures of these paintings up so people can understand, like, the gravity of this situation?
The gravity of the situation. Woo! All right, so yeah. All right, check this out. I was a painting major in college.
What?
All right. Yeah.
Oh, my gosh. All these people are doing amazing things. I love everyone. Thank you for living your best life, you guys. For real.
Your best life. I love that that's like a pop cultural phrase,
yes,
right now, right? Living your best life. Yeah. I was a painting major in college. I went to SUNY New Paltz. Shout out to New Paltz. Go Hawks, you know. The thing is, I don't know if this is going to surprise anybody, it's relatively difficult to figure out how to make a living as a painter, okay? So, interestingly, it never really turned into a career for me. It feels a little bit more like a maybe a glorified hobby at this point, and that's okay. I was like, you know, the star quarterback of artists in my high school, if that makes sense. Like, I was like that guy voted most artistic and so forth. I won some various scholastic awards, which are national awards, when I was in high school and all that. But it just never really turned into something that I felt that it didn't make me tick quite in the way that something else did that I discovered when I was in college. And that was I became an RA, a residential advisor. Many people laugh, haha, the RA, the guy that would write us up when we were drinking. Well, yeah, that person, but that's not what really made me tick. What made me tick was the idea that I could be a leader among peers, putting on programs and events, being a resource for people in some sort of crisis. That really did make me tick. And I think it was one of the most transformative experiences I had, growing up, let alone in college. I ended up being an RA for 7 semesters. All right. That's 3.5 years for those of you keeping up. And it really became a thing that I sank my teeth into, so much so that it qualified me to be a residence hall director when I graduated from college. So I embarked on this career in student services. And 1 year after graduating college, I found myself as the residence hall director for Clara Dixon Hall and the Multicultural Living Learning Unit at Cornell University. And that's how I arrived here 17 years ago. After that, by the way, I was the residence hall director for the Risley Residential College for the Creative and Performing Arts, which also dovetailed with my personality and interests, so much so at that point. But, you know, this is sort of my background in professional terms. So I want to stress I'm not like a professional artist, even though
I should say otherwise. So
let me rephrase that. I'm not a career artist, if that makes more sense.
But it's
right?
Very professional, like, so, modern day Michelangelo status.
Oh,
you guys.
Stop it. No.
No. Yes.
All right. So the painting series that you are referring to is currently on display in the lobby of the K House Karaoke Bar here in Ithaca, which has been around for, I don't know, a little more than half a decade at this point.
Really? Oh my
but
gosh.
Folks that, you know, didn't live here within the last 5 decades have no idea what we're talking about. This is a full-blown, hyper, hyper detailed and awesome Korean style karaoke bar with different rooms you can rent out or whatever. But there's the large bar area right out front. And you know, it is...
These are like huge paintings, too.
Yeah, I have some 4-foot-tall portraits of deceased hip-hop artists hanging in there in their main sort of bar area. And I used photographs that I found in the hip-hop archives as the reference points for
That's
these
amazing.
Portraits that I painted. And so that's what you're referring to. Yes. I don't know about Michelangelo status. I've never painted a ceiling.
Close enough.
You know, I'd like to explore painting a ceiling at some point in time, but it is what it is.
Are you on the mural scene here?
I love murals. I, however, have not painted
that
murals.
That was an interesting response.
I'm not that guy. Yeah. No, I have, you know, when we're talking about murals and visual art in the context of hip hop, oftentimes we're talking about something called graffiti art, right? Sometimes it's called street art. Sometimes it's called aerosol art. Sometimes it's called style writing. But fundamentally, I think most people understand it as graffiti. And we are blessed to have, you know,
It's like Ithaca is murals, amazing, and there's like a whole thing on
it. Yeah, we have an amazing public arts commission who's constantly inviting world-class caliber, amazing, mind-blowingly dope muralists to town, most of whom are painting with aerosol medium, so that's fundamentally spray paint, right? Not all of whom are technically graffiti artists in that they're doing lettering and words, but many are doing image-based street murals. And sometimes there's this blurry understanding of what graffiti is. I think the hardcore graffiti artists refer to it just really as, you know, letters first, right? So that's just the distinction for y'all. But I'm not out there painting murals in this community like that. And frankly, it's a time issue between the job that I have and DJing
and all the other things you're
and
doing.
Just trying to like sleep enough, you know.
Yep.
I don't think I could really commit myself to that in a way that other folks have. So shout out to all the muralists that have been in town and the cats who live here doing it big every day. We have a really dope little scene here.
So you have kind of like spearheaded, I don't know if it's called DJ movement here, but like the cruises and I don't know whatever else, but I feel like you're doing the most with all the DJ stuff. So can you tell us a little bit about that for people who don't live here and know the ins and outs of all of that?
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't know. I don't know if I want to take credit for spearheading anything in particular. I will just say that I try to be a strong voice for the DJ community and advocating for us as artists and performers in a way that sometimes we're forgotten in a community that is very heavily saturated with bands. Band being defined as a group of people who are playing more traditional instruments like guitars and horns and so forth. And that's not to say that there aren't people who are sort of hybridizing those two things. My group, Dubber Rucky, the Junkyard Theory, for example, and perhaps a few others. So, you know, I'm trying to be, you know, a person who is able to use a degree of influence and connections to promote those things. I started something 2 years ago called the Ithaca DJ Festival, which is an all-day event designed to put us more front and center in the music community. It takes place in March because...
How's that been going? I haven't been able to make it in. I'm sorry.
It's been, you know, if I may, it's been extremely successful in that we didn't bite off more than we could chew in the beginning.
It's a
one-day event. This past year, I incorporated workshops and lectures as part of the festival along with the DJ performances, whereas the first year was 100% DJ performances. The Argos Warehouse has been our home for these past 2 years, and they've been awesome to work with. So shout out to Avi and Tippy and that whole squad. We have a lot of potential for growth, and I'm glad we didn't try to be this giant weekend-long behemoth to start off with. But I think maybe moving into a two-day model at some point makes sense. Fitting in all these DJs is difficult. There are more DJs per capita here than probably in like New York City, right? And I stress per capita. Just like we have more, you know, Thai restaurants per capita, it's important to recognize the per capita piece.
Yes.
So, you know, it's a love affair with DJing. I can't tell you how much it makes me, you know, feel happy and satisfied to make people dance out there and see people kind of, you know, sweating their problems away on a Friday night, Saturday night, whatever. And, you know, it's been a great journey so far. That's another thing I feel like I'm really just at the tip of the iceberg with. I just did a major festival in Rochester this past weekend called the Fringe Festival. And, you know, I had maybe 1,000 people out in this open space doing the wobble, Cupid shuffle, conga lines, and all kinds of stuff, and then throwing on something unexpected and seeing them kind of bug out. It's very satisfying to see in a position to make people feel good. And I think DJs do that fundamentally. So promoting DJ culture is something that's become that's a flag I fly. You know.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, and you mentioned the cruises. I got to shout out Discover Cayuga Lake, which is the nonprofit organization that invited myself and three other DJs last year to DJ on their double-decker boats out on Cayuga Lake over the summer. So our cruises have been very successful. We're going to close those out within the next 2 weeks, though. We stop in, you know, the end of September. And if you're in town next summer, look us up. Yeah,
definitely. So, okay, you're curating the hip hop collection, DJing, doing all these festivals, whatever. And then you're like, wait a minute, let me start a podcast called Wakanda with all these people. And it's so amazing. So, like, why did you decide to do that? What gave you the inspiration?
Well, you know, on a bigger zoom out for a second, I think I've discovered I'm this like jack of all trades type of person. Jack of all trades.
Very common theme today. Master of none.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
Yes.
Jack of all trades, master of none. But whatever.
Can you name the episode that, Amanda? We're talking to Amanda a lot during this. We need
Amanda's
to get her
over
mic
here nodding. We need to give you a microphone. I rarely see Amanda without
Morse
a microphone.
She's doing Morse code on the desk.
Yeah, yeah. She's trying not to laugh out loud for some reason, as if the sound of her voice laughing would disturb the flow somehow. But
you
I don't
think
so.
You can laugh. We give you permission.
Just give us a woo.
Yeah.
There you go. All right.
She's for real.
She's for real. So I love the medium of podcasting. I think, you know, I love radio.
Me too.
I've always loved radio. Right, since I was a child. And podcasting is fundamentally broadcasting. That's why it's called podcasting, right? It's just that it's, you know, it's a downloadable file, whatever. I had a radio show in college. I had a radio show here at Cornell on the first internet network. What was that called? Slope Media. Radio.
That's still a thing, I think.
Is it still a thing? This was
maybe.
Myself and two colleagues were the first staff radio show at Cornell.
Oh my gosh.
It was called Old School is in Session. It was like kind of an old school hip hop show. This is back in like 04, 05, 06. So I love the medium. And so any opportunity to really do a podcast, I tend to jump on. And a colleague of mine in human resources, Cassie Joseph, shout out to Cassie, and I kind of had been speaking about this particular idea, and this is in the context of so Cassie manages staff resource groups called the Colleague Network groups, and they tend to be identity based groups. So I'm on the I'm a executive board member of the Men of Color Colleague Network
group.
Right. And so our group decided it would be a fun idea to start a podcast, which evolved over the course of an entire semester into this thing called Wakanda. And we started this thing the semester that Black Panther came out. So most people maybe have seen that movie or have heard of Wakanda, which is this it's a fictional country, but it's an African country that Black Panther comes from. It is highly technologically advanced, and yet most of the world doesn't know a whole lot about it. So we thought, let's call it Wakanda because it's about work. We're talking about Cornell and our professional fields. Wakanda, you know, podcasting is very high tech, right? And we're talking about topics that most people don't know about. For example, our last episode that we recorded, which I'm in the process of editing right now, is about mental health issues among professional staff members. Mm. We all find ourselves focusing on the mental health needs of the students almost exclusively, as we should, but we don't hear it discussed often enough with staff, faculty, and so forth. So that's what our topic was about there.
Oh my gosh, I wish I could have been there because I'm in Res Life now.
Are
at
you?
At Binghamton, yeah.
Why didn't you tell me that? At Bingo?
Yeah.
Shout out to University of Bingo.
So they're putting MSW interns, like social workers, in every res hall.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's deep. That's deep. Well, we'll get you on an episode at
oh
some
gosh,
point.
Yeah. Love it.
So the podcast is sort of a project of the Cornell HR department. And I am the co-producer along with Cassie. I edit the whole thing. You know, it's still relatively new. So we're trying to get it to the point where maybe we can pump out content a little bit more frequently. But at the moment, it's a real DIY, do-it-yourself style thing, mm-hmm. as I think is it should be. You know, it's not subject to this sort of like, you know, large oversight from a particular
But it is through
apparatus.
Cornell, right? So you got to like keep it classy.
Well, it's in this fuzzy area between, yes, it's from Cornell and yes, it features mostly Cornell employees. But it's also intended to, you know, be us after we leave the office.
Oh,
for
yeah,
because
in the beginning you say like the views expressed like aren't.
That's right. The views expressed are not necessarily those of Cornell University.
Yes.
And those types of disclaimers are important because we want to be ourselves. We want to not just seem like, you know, mouthpieces for the university. And that's not to say that there's anything wrong with what the university would want us to say. Of course, 99% of the time, it dovetails very nicely.
Yeah.
It's just not, you know, if it were from the Cornell Media Relations Office, I'm sure there'd be a lot more strict adherence to particular guidelines, which is fine. But in our case, it would not necessarily let us kind of be ourselves in that regard. If that makes sense.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
Totally.
And it's not, there's no animosity or adversarial relationship or anything like that. It's just we wanted to have something that would be not only a recruitment and retention tool for Cornell staff, particularly staff of color, particularly people who are not necessarily thinking that Ithaca is a great obvious location for them to move.
Yeah.
But, you know, for our colleagues across the whole planet who might find our show to be a resource.
Well, and it's what I like about it is it's the topic is broad. So I think one of them was like, what, toxic masculinity
toxic
or something?
Masculinity.
Yeah. And so it's like, that's not just a Cornell
thing,
you know? Like anyone can listen to that from any university or any like workplace, any human person.
Our featured
and that's relevant,
yeah,
right?
That's right. Our featured speaker on that episode was Rock Lash from Ithaca College. So, you know, we're not just trying to be just Cornell, but
So I've interviewed you before, and I could probably talk to you like for hours and hours because you have so many great things to say.
Oh, shucks.
Not to throw Amanda in the bus, but she's giving me the warning, and I'm very sad
that we have to
cut this conversation off because we could just go on forever. But I do want to make sure I thank you for taking time to come down here and chat with us. Is there anything that, like, we didn't cover that you're like, man, I really wanted to say this, Juliana?
Oh, boy. I don't really think so. I also could just talk. Maybe that's why each episode of Wakanda tends to top out at about 90 minutes, you know. But at the same time, no. There's always more to be had, and I hope that maybe I can join you all again in the future.
Well, what I like is you said people can contact you, too, right?
If
they have questions, to just, like, hit you up.
I get contacted from people all across the planet on a daily basis where I have to respond to researchers and so forth, so please don't hesitate.
Awesome. Thank you so much for coming in today.
My pleasure.
This is so exciting.
Thanks for inviting me.
Yes, have a good day.
Peace.
Thank you for tuning in to this episode of Fresh from the Hill. Music for Fresh from the Hill was written, produced, and recorded by Kia Albertson Rogers, class of 2013. You can contact him at koa3@cornell.edu. For more information about the podcast and Cornell Young Alumni programs, visit our website at alumni.cornell.edu/youngalumni.